Salutations, Mets fans, and welcome to this week's edition, a slightly soberer edition, of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and with me this week is Greg Karam. Greg.
Jeff.
This week, I think it's been in the last week or thereabouts, Chipper Jones predicted the Mets would win the 2016 World Series, and Steve Phillips has them atop his power rankings. So, What figure, cultural, sports, or otherwise, predicting success for the Mets would make you more uncomfortable than those two?
I don't know, maybe Derek Jeter or somebody related to the Yankees like that.
I think Derek Jeter, it's not quite the same as Chipper, I feel like, though.
Right, I mean, like, what do you want, like Pat Burrell?
Does that be a Mets killer? I don't know.
No, well, actually,
it's just like, I'm thinking, like, Chipper is a specific thing. I'm thinking people that are generally wrong about baseball, like Steve Phillips.
I think that the type of person that would make me most uncomfortable if they predicted success for the team would be somebody on the team, you know, who kind of put that bullseye on
like
their back.
The 2007 Carlos Beltran or whatever?
That kind of thing. You don't want to have that
2008,
thrown back in
actually. Yeah.
You don't want to throw them back in your face.
Bryce Harper said they're the team to beat, too.
Well, when you're the defending National League champs,
yeah,
you know, you are the team to beat.
I think the one that would scare me the most is John Morosi.
That's a good one. Or Jonah Carey or something like that, right?
Yeah, the architects of the Marlins takeover.
Yeah.
It is weird, though. We haven't really talked about this. We talked about it a little bit sort of at the end of last year that it was going to be different this season with them coming in as the favorites, more or less.
Yeah.
It's a little different. I don't know. I haven't quite gotten a handle on it yet.
Yeah. It's going to be weird. It's watching the games and you're just going to be assuming big. It's going to be similar to the way it was probably in August and September of last year.
Yeah. I mean, they could go like 4-6 off the hop and Mets Twitter will immediately descend back into chaos. It's very possible. Whether that portends actual doom or not. I'm trying to think like the last time I felt like this. Because 2006 is not a great parallel. It kind of is. Like, you thought they'd be good going into that season with the Delgado and LaDuca moves.
Yeah.
But the division,
well, they cruised.
They cruised, for one. The division still felt open, and they hadn't done it before.
Yeah.
Now they've done it before. But 2015 doesn't feel like 2006 to me. It left less of a bad taste in my mouth. For a variety of reasons, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
But we're in that kind of like 2007 mode now, where I feel like that's the only parallel I can come up with, and that's not a good one. Because I'd not say they're expected to win the division. I think even in 2007, you know, the Phillies were ascendant. The Braves weren't terrible at that point, as I recall.
You know, I think that, right, it's a little bit closer this year. I think that people understand that it's not a slam dunk for them to win a division this year, because the Nationals are still a contender and they still have the best player in not only the division, but in the league. So there's definitely something to be concerned about there.
Sure. And the gap, I'll put it this way, the gap between the Mets and Nationals going into 2016 is much less significant than the perceived gap between the Nationals and the Mets going into 2015. And we saw how that played out. But at a certain point, it's tough to keep. You know, I'm going to walk into Citi Field for the first time at some point, probably in April in 2016, and see like the Eastern Division and NL Championship pennants on the wall. And it's tough to talk yourself out of them being really good after that. Once you consider their offseason as well, and a full year of all the young pitchers.
And the rest of the division outside of the Nationals.
Yes.
I mean, it would be, you know, at this point, it would shock me if they didn't win at least 90 games, you know?
Is that an official prediction, Greg? You're predicting to win 90, is a 90-win team? We've heard that before, I feel like.
I That's not a prediction. That's a floor of my prediction, I would say.
That's a.
That's the floor. I am highly optimistic.
I guess you can't. I guess
year.
You can't shame retweet podcast audio. So
that's right. That's right.
It might be opening a show before the theme music in September, though. Just so you know.
I'll write it down. Episode whatever we are on.
173 of Amazing Avenue Audio. In fact, it's our catching preview. Talk a little bit about Travis d'Arnaud, Kevin Plawecki, and others, maybe. But mainly those two.
Ned also, and Ashley.
Ray Willie Gomez.
Yeah.
Johnny Manel still around.
He is.
I think Jorge Carrillo, too, but it's tough to keep track.
Yeah.
Anyone else your emails? I think I said that already. And we'll do an IFK Gothenburg update. It'll be a brisk show. Not really, because it hasn't been so far. We haven't even gotten into the agenda. But we will start with the catchers, and we'll start with Travis d'Arnaud. And a question of sorts. That's how I've kind of been framing these, I guess. How many games will Travis d'Arnaud play this year, Greg?
So this is tough, because last year, right, he gets hurt on a kind of a freak collision at home plate, right? When I forget who ran into him, but he was catching the ball.
He was reaching and back and hyperextended his elbow, yeah.
Spun him around. And then afterwards, I kind of said that this guy is injury prone. You know, and it's tough to throw that tag on somebody and like, what does that actually mean? Is staying healthy a skill, or are some people just, you know, more brittle than others? And I'm kind of leaning towards that this guy's injury prone, because
well,
been
I don't know if it's
year.
Injury prone per se, but you do get dinged up as a catcher.
Yes,
and I think there's something to that he doesn't recover from that kind of stuff as quickly as others.
Sure, but like I mean, things break on him easily. I would say, right? I mean, he's
Mr.
got
Glass, yeah,
yeah. You know, he's got a little bit of the Samuel L. Jackson going on. But then, you know, he came back and he played the rest of the year after he came back, you know, with little to no issues at all. So you know, it's tough to know. I'll say he probably plays – I'm going to say he plays 120 games this year.
That's ambitious.
It is. It is. But I think there is a flukiness to it.
There is, right. But you get those – it's fluky, but when you're behind the plate, you – get into those kind of situations.
Right.
Where that kind of stuff can happen. I mean, fouling a ball off your foot is one thing, but...
I know. It's tough to know, because some of the things... is a foul ball off his foot, his toe breaks. You know, maybe some other guy's doesn't. I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not, or if it is just the flukiness to it.
Yeah, I don't know either. But until he plays 120 games in a season, it's kind of tough to predict it, I feel like.
Right. I mean, if you want an actual, you know, prediction based on a bell curve, what's the most, you know, what's the mean outcome? It's probably less than that.
I looked at Pakoda, I think, has him based on plate appearances somewhere between 100 and 110 games.
Yeah, that's probably, I mean, that I guess that is what they would say.
And Pakoda likes him. Sees him as one of the better catchers in baseball.
Well, he is one of the better catchers
he
in
is.
Baseball.
He is. He's got to stay on the field. You have him as a stealth MVP candidate.
I do. Well, if he does stay healthy.
Yeah.
Right? He was based on weighted runs created plus.
Right.
He's the second best hitter last year as a catcher.
Yes.
Behind Buster Posey.
Yes.
So you take that, you take in, he's okay behind the plate, but he's got the framing ability.
He does.
Which adds value.
We'll talk about that in a second. I'm still skeptical about scale, but I'm coming around. Harry's Pavlidis' last sort of salvo has convinced me to a certain extent.
I'm a believer. I'm a big believer in framing and the value that it adds, because not only do I trust some of the stuff that I've read on it, but it also kind of adds up to the eye test. You know, these are things that you can notice in the game.
Sure. I'm also realizing how like completely sycophantic it sounds. Like, oh, I recently got hired by Baseball Prospectus, and Harry's last article on that convinced me. I still don't fully buy in for a variety of reasons, but it's something I'm keeping in mind more. I think I'm weighting framing versus other catcher defensive skills differently than I was previously. I'll say that.
Fair enough. But you take that, if he plays, what if he doesn't get hurt this year? Plays the whole year. He's probably going to be a stealth MVP candidate because there's going to be that soft value that's not going to be added up into your two major WAR metrics out there.
He's a stealth candidate by sort of, yeah, by...
You know, like Jonathan Lucroy a couple years
ago. Not actually getting any MVP votes, but...
Right, no, but somebody will write an article on Fangraphs or something and talk about it.
So Pakoda's weighted mean for him next year has him in a little over 100 games being worth about 3.5 wins, but only hitting .249, .320, .432, which is actually excellent for a catcher. But I think he can outpace that.
Yeah.
And again, you get into the issues with Pakoda still sort of considering his first 100 games or so before his demotion to Vegas in 2014. He's been a different hitter since then.
Yes.
But even so, it's like he doesn't have to. That's still like a really good catcher.
Right. Right. But there's upside in that bat.
Yes. I mean, if he hit .280, .330, .460 this year, I would not be surprised.
Yeah. I mean, if he slugged .500, it wouldn't shock me.
I mean, he has that home run he hit in Philly last year, like onto the pavilion.
Yeah, he's got some it's crazy power.
Yeah.
And he's not a big dude.
No, it's like sneaky bat speed. It's like the Dilson Herrera thing, where it's like sneaky bat speed. He's very stout, but everything stays in and is quick.
Yeah. Oh, that home run he hit off the apple against the Cubs. That was a bomb.
So without checking, Greg Karam.
Mm-hmm.
2016 will be Travis d'Arnaud's age blank season.
27?
It doesn't feel like it, but I guess he's been around forever at this point.
And he got delayed by a few injuries
and everything. And catcher development curves are weird.
But. Right. I mean, he was still on the prospect list when he was like 24 years old.
Yeah. I think they already talked about him taking some, you know, first base reps in spring training, which is a thing you talk about on February 23rd. Talking about Matt Reynolds in the outfield too. So, but he's an interesting. So they don't really have a backup first baseman for Duda, as Mets Twitter, I think, is well aware, or even really a platoon candidate. And d'Arnaud's an interesting one in that regard, because it allows you to get his bat into the lineup more. So you might give him a day by playing him at first base. He crushes lefties. It's not the worst idea in the world.
It's not the worst idea in the world, but I mean...
It's entirely possible Collins just plays Duda against lefties all year, because it's Terry Collins. Right. We know what we're getting into.
Right. But I mean, Flores hits lefties too, but yeah, it's not a bad idea to get d'Arnaud in there and rest his knees for a game a little bit. But who knows how they're going to take to that. And
in a perfect world, you know, d'Arnaud and Flores are your right side infield against lefties, but we know that's not going to happen. So in the more likely world, Flores is playing third base against lefties because David Wright is hurt. So something that came out this week, that an interesting Travis d'Arnaud story that surprised me a little bit. I guess he and Yoenis are buddy-buddy now.
Really?
But the reason is they share a taste in country music, which on both sides is a little odd. I mean, Cespedes on one level is rural as fuck, from some of the stories I've heard.
Yeah.
But, like, d'Arnaud I always sort of saw as, like, sort of the Southern California surfer bro.
He's an LA high school guy. And his walk-up music is Drake, so I just kind of doesn't...
They bonded over their love of country music.
I'm sure there's a bunch of guys in there that like country music.
Yeah. I mean, it's baseball, so.
Yeah.
That is a thing that happens.
Yeah. That's surprising. It seems like a lot of people like Cespedes on the Mets.
He's a likable guy.
Yeah, it seems that
way. They just want to ride in his car.
Yeah. I don't know how you go over like a speed bump in that car, man.
You don't. Like, they tested it on Top Gear. It's not even. I don't. It's. I mean, it's Florida, so it might be street legal in Florida, but I feel like in most places that's not street legal. That's a track day car.
Yeah.
It's a Polaris Slingshot. Apparently, he has two of them in different color schemes.
Well, that's the other thing. Is like, how does he? He's got two cars down there, or like.
Well, he has the pickup. He brought the pickup the first day.
Brought the pickup. So what?
And now he's having the apparently because the Slingshot went over so well, he's having the Lambo like shipped down from his house or whatever. I'm gonna take that tomorrow.
This is ridiculous.
I mean, just have someone drive it. You don't need to put it in a trailer. It's a Lamborghini. There's a few. I've driven down I-95 in Florida. You see a few of them.
How many cars do you need on for spring training?
On one level, I like that he hasn't gone like full like annoying rich person car, because the Polaris is a track day car, but it's not like super expensive. He's tricked it out, but it's under $25,000 base.
Oh, really?
He's not driving like a Bugatti Veyron or a whatever the new crazy like hybrid McLaren is.
I don't even know. I mean, all these guys got nice cars.
Usually it's tricked out pickups. I guess the same company that did his, I saw a tweet, I think it was from Anthony DiComo. They're doing a custom Dodge SRT for Familia. And Cologne's on board too. I'm trying to figure out what Cologne's going to drive. He needs like a midlife crisis dad car, I feel like. Like some ridiculous two-seater convertible. They're bringing back the Honda NSX, an Acura NSX. I'd like to see him in that.
I just want to see him in something that's like really hard to get into and out of for his size.
Well, I mean, anything that's like low slung two seater mid engine is probably going to be difficult to get in and out of. So.
Yes, that's what I want to see.
He's not that tall though, so you could like cram him in probably.
Yeah, but like I want the steering wheel to be like right up on his nipples.
Like an Alfa Romeo 4C. It doesn't even have power steering. We should move on to Kevin Plawecki now. That's your auto talk for the week.
He, you know, his 2015 eerily kind of looked like Travis Darno's first year for the Mets in terms of just triple slash. Like, it was just, I mean, it was a struggle for him.
Yeah, I don't think the... Obviously, the same offensive upside isn't there. But do you think it'll be better in 2015, 2016, now that he's adjusted sort of the major league catcher thing?
I have, like, no basis to say that, yes, he will. But that's what I'll say, just because now I'm a kind of believer that, you know, catchers take a little while. It's something that we said about catchers before Darno.
Young catcher stagnation syndrome, as John Sickles coined it.
Yeah. So I could see that happening. But, I mean, you know, it was a real struggle for him last year, not just at the major league level, too. I mean, he didn't get in AAA either.
I saw a quote somewhere. It's like, oh, he swung it. It actually might have been this year's prospectus annual quote about him, or capsule. So I probably shouldn't slag it, but I'm going to. Said he like swung and missed at like 40% of breaking balls out of the zone or something like that. Something ridiculous.
Wow.
But he's not a very aggressive hitter. No, he's a very aggressive hitter.
He didn't
have low walk rates in the minors because no one really wanted to pitch to him in those lineups because he was the best hitter in most of the lineups he was playing in. But dude likes to swing. I mean, he's not like Juan Lagares, but he likes to swing. It's not going to be a crazy...
Yeah.
A crazy, like, high walk rate guy. And he had a very good strikeout to walk rate in college. That's because he never struck out. I mean, he can hit. And I think he will hit a little bit more, but I don't know if there's huge offensive upside. Pakoda has him at 239, 292, 352. Which, in this day and age, is an above average defensive catcher because, like Darno, he's a very good framer. Is worth a little over one win in 60 games, which is good for your backup catcher.
Yeah, I can live with that.
His 70th percentile projection, if you believe the bat's going to improve, his 70th percentile projection is 253, 312, 378, which feels right-ish to me, having watched him.
Yeah.
as a prospect.
That does feel like something that he could hit this year.
Yeah, and in 60 games in a backup role, that's worth almost 2 wins as a good defensive catcher.
He's a good defensive catcher. He's got good framing.
Very good framing.
He's good blocker, not as great throwing out guys.
His arm has improved, and we're going to talk about Ali Sanchez in a second because there's not many other catchers in the organization to talk about who kind of had similar issues, having seen both of them as prospects. So it does seem like they fixed Plawecki to a certain extent. And he just doesn't have a strong arm. That's the reality of the situation. But it's gotten more accurate and more consistent, which is all you can really ask for. And if you believe that framing scales much wider than base runner kills do, which I think is not unreasonable, that's one of the things that I think I've gotten out of the recent catcher defensive data at Baseball Prospectus, having dove into it, Plawecki's a good defensive catcher.
Yep.
If you want to look at comps, I think it's Bakota comps this year. Jonathan Lucroy's in there. Very exciting. Also, Curtis Thigpen. I don't know who Curtis Thigpen is. I didn't bother to look it up because it's funnier to just say Curtis Thigpen and leave it at that.
Sure.
I mean, he played in the majors at some point because it's a Bakota comp, but do not remember at all. Jeff Mathis was in there, too, if you want, like, somebody you might have heard of. So, you have anything on Ray Willie Gomez? Nevin Ashley, Johnny Manel.
All not very good.
Likely one of them will end up in the majors at some point this year just because of catcher attrition.
Yeah.
Darnell or Plawecki will spend 2 weeks on the DL.
Ray Willie has pretty solid strikeout and walk numbers in the minors. So that's something. And Nevin Ashley apparently has big power, but it hasn't really shown up in the minors at all. So, and Johnny, and neither of these guys are particularly good with the framing stats that BP has put out recently for the minors. So,
I would vote for Johnny Manel just if he starts walking up to Johnny Royale by the Beastie Boys.
Yeah,
that would be the tiebreaker for me between the three.
That's totally understandable.
Because there's really nothing else to separate them in my mind.
Nope. I mean, yeah, that strikeout walk numbers for Ray Willie are pretty good, but he hasn't gotten out of Double A yet, so.
The Mets have been weird about the, I mean, you always need those minor league free agent non-roster invitee catcher types for spring training and the upper minors. That's just a fact of life. You need a lot of catchers when pitchers and catchers report, because there's a lot of pitchers, and they need people to throw to. I'm sure they probably called up Kai Gronauer and had him just fly in to
From Germany
or wherever he is now. Jean-Luc Blackier from Quebec, whatever. Just get in here. We need somebody to catch.
Get his glasses back.
Yeah. I think I've officially told that story on the podcast. So that's,
I think
so. It's fair game. but it's weird they've gotten guys that haven't gotten out of Double A, because Manel was like that too. Like, I think they had Dan Rolfing at some point last year from the Twin system.
They did.
I saw a bunch of him in New Britain, but he at least played in AAA. It always has kind of seemed a little bit odd to me that the non-roster invitee catchers they target. But there's nobody else in the system. There's no one else in the system. The best catching prospect in the system is Ali Sanchez, who spent last year in the Gulf Coast League. And I like him a lot. By Baseball Prospectus, Mets list drops on Thursday. He is on it, spoiler alert. But he has similar issues. And I'm starting to think about, to Kevin Plawecki, as I mentioned, I'm starting to rethink how I evaluate catching prospects. I've said before on the show that evaluating catchers is one of my weak points as a scouty type. And I specifically focused on Ali Sanchez's framing and receiving when I was down in St. Lucie this past summer, because Wally Backman said he was the best framer in the system at the Metropolitan Baseball Convention.
Queens Baseball?
Queens Baseball Convention, that's what it is. The previous offseason, I'm like, all right, I got to see this. But he's a very good receiver. So it's like, how do you weight that? And we've seen it with Plawecki and Darnell. And look, Darnell had issues throwing out the Royals in the World Series, as we know. And he's had issues blocking balls in the past as well. in part possibly due to his attempts to frame, especially the low strike. You know, I'm going to write about this in prospectus after the Mets list goes up. But if you really buy into the idea that framing is a more important defensive skill for a catcher than throwing, and there's other things in Sanchez's game I like too, the way he sort of handles a pitching staff, he's very mature for his age. There's an argument he should be much higher on my list than he is. Because he can, I think he'll hit. And the bar for catcher offense is very low, as we know, just looking at sort of Kevin Plawecki's.
Yeah.
For the past couple years.
If you buy into framing, catchers could be severely undervalued, especially at the prospect level.
And we're not going to have framing data for him until probably double A or so. But I see he plays in the Penn League this year. We have Penn League framing data now, so, which he very well might.
Yeah.
But that's it. It's the old Kevin Goldstein joke. It's not a draft until the Mets overdraft a catcher. They haven't really done that in the last few years, so.
That feels like a previous regime joke.
Well, he made it after they drafted Kevin Plawecki, who oddly is the one guy that's the one guy of them all of them that's worked out.
Yeah,
it was like Blake Forsythe, Doc Doyle. I guess Blake Forsythe is the coach at Tennessee now. I feel very old.
We are all getting older.
It is true. I'm just sitting here listening. You're to the podcast. You're getting older because it's going on too long. So we'll move on to your emails. Before we do emails, we do housekeeping. This is Amazing Avenue Audio, episode 173. Amazing Avenue Audio is the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. You can find us on the internet at AmazingAvenue.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. And join our Facebook group at Facebook.com/AmazingAvenue, which I understand has been a tire fire this week.
What, Facebook?
Yeah, and Facebook's always a tire fire, so.
Oh, yeah, well, that'll happen.
You find the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Amazing Avenue Audio, and you can listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to do both. I also encourage you to rate and review the podcast. We haven't had any reviews in a while. Review the goddamn podcast. Jesus. You also find the podcast on the Stitcher app. Download directly. I supposed to be slightly soberer this week. Download directly from blogtalkradio.com/AmazingAvenue. Or listen to the embedded player that goes up in the podcast post at Amazing Avenue proper. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro. You can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. Don't at me about my Mets list. I'm doing a BP chat. Send it there. My co-host this week is Greg Karam. You can follow him on Twitter at Greg Karam. That was the housekeeping. These are your emails. You can email the podcast at podcast@AmazingAvenueAudio.com. And our first email is from Christopher. Hey guys. As of now, it looks like Dilson Herrera will contribute fairly little in terms of playing time this season for the Mets, which is a good thing. It's nice to see the Mets going for a proven major league stopgap like Neil Walker, instead of rolling the dice with a very young player after a World Series appearance. Going forward, however, the Mets will likely give Herrera a shot to be their long-term second-base option. I'm pretty excited about that. I know he's not technically a prospect anymore, but I look around the Mets system and I see him as one of the most promising young players that we have. He's a full year younger than Brandon Nimmo, he's got major league playing time, and he's flashed some amazing power for such a tiny dude. In your minds, where does he work? Where does he rank? In terms of future value among Mets minor leaguers under 25, is he potentially a 55 major leaguer one day? People seem to go apeshit for Dom Smith. But isn't Dilson a more proven, valuable asset at this point? Wouldn't he rank ahead of Dom on prospect lists if he was still a prospect? He plays up the middle. I'm being very good right now. And has more proven pop and athleticism than Dom has shown to this point. Plus, they're nearly the same age. Also, side question. Would the organization ever consider teaching Herrera to play center? I know he has no arm, but he has decent speed. And if he could pass in center, his bat would make him pretty valuable there, right? I know this is a long email. I just find it funny how excited some people seem to get about players like Dom Smith and Brandon Nimmo. When Dilson Herrera possesses a better range of skills than either of them, I know he's tiny, but so is Dustin Pedroia, and I don't see why Herrera couldn't be Dustin Pedroia if he hits his 90th percentile outcome. Well, he's a 10% chance of doing that. Maybe I'm insane. I'm just way too high on him, Chris. I don't think you're way too high on him.
No, it's like, where would you put him? Where would you put him if you had a rank?
He'd be number two.
Yeah.
He'd be behind Matt. It falls into the not a prospect, not a regular conundrum. He's like in limbo. And he's going to be 22 all season. I think he turns 22 in a month or so. He's younger than Gavin Cecchini. He's younger than Brandon Nimmo. He's younger than Robert Gesellman. He's only 9 months older than Willer Becerra, who spent all of last year in A-ball. And Rule 55 sounds about right. And there's upside there still. I mean, I don't want to scoop our 25 and under list, which I'm not writing, but I wouldn't be shocked if he's third behind Matt, or fourth behind Matt Syndergaard and Conforto.
Is Matt still 25 and under? Yeah, I guess. Yeah, he's 25, right?
Yeah, he'll be age 25 this year.
Yeah.
Which is funny because he's on the prospect list because he hasn't pitched 50 innings yet, but he's,
yeah.
I wouldn't call, he barely qualifies for the 25 and under list. I mean, I think we've seen...
But it's...
He's had some issues. I don't want to say he's had some issues adjusting to major league pitching because it's tough to gauge at this point. But we don't view him as a prospect, so the lens is a little different.
And he's been okay even in his limited experience in the majors. So I think that there's a lot of upside there. And I think the Mets think that too. I think that they wanted to give him another year.
I don't know if they wanted to give him another year, but Walker's here because it's win now. And you want you want lower variance on good teams and higher variance on less good teams. It's the 2015 Mets versus the 2016 Mets. Sort of the argument I made last spring training, they should start Montero or Syndergaard or Matz over Dylan G. Because if you think they're an 84 or 85 win team, you want the guys that could pop something spectacular. Dylan G wasn't going to do that. This year, if you think their floor is a 90 win team, you want the guy that's not going to fuck it up.
Yeah.
And Neil Walker is probably not going to fuck it up based on his track record.
I agree with that.
But I think the podcast is pro Dilson Herrera in general. I've always been very... very high on him.
I'm a big fan.
Our next email is from Johnny Caps. Hey Jeff, loving our potential lineup versus righties, but I think left-handed pitching could be an issue for this lineup. As you well know, we have a few hitters who've had issues hitting lefties, and we know TC loves a good, or not good, platoon. What would your lineup be against left-handed pitchers, assuming right is on the disabled list? It's depressing. It's February 23rd. Come on.
Yeah.
Is when we're playing third base, second base, and first base. Thanks as always, Johnny.
Well, that's a little tough. Ideally, you'd be liking to have Flores play second, replacing Walker, who has
It's a strict platooning issue versus the value of playing every day and sort of managing the locker room. Because you can make an argument that Legarra should play center field against lefties every single day. If you're looking to win, you know, maximizing your chances to win over 162 games, Legarra is playing center field against lefties, benching Conforto, moving Cespedes to left, sort of the defensive-offensive balance. I mean, basically how they treated August and September last year. That could be the model. You know, put Travis d'Arnaud and Flores on the right side of the infield against lefties. Now, that kind of runs counter to what I said coming into the playoffs, where just start your best lineup. But now you have options. You have really good options. You're not playing Michael Kadire at first base. You have fairly proven platoon hitters. But there is value in playing every day and getting reps. I mean, if Wright is on the disabled list, I think Wilmer Flores is playing third base full time. So,
yeah, I think so too. And I think that they are going to platoon the outfield like that.
You think?
I think they're going to handle it the same way they handle it.
I guess Conforto is young enough that, yeah, we'll see.
I really do.
I don't know if it'll be a strict platoon, but. And again, people are going to get hurt. It's going to be fluid. They have a deep bench right now, which you should be happy about, whether they strictly platoon them or not.
Yeah, people are going to get hurt, and people are going to play all over the place, so not too concerned about it.
I mean, if it was me, yeah, I would definitely start Flores and Darno against every lefty. I mean, Flores really matches lefties. It's like an extreme platoon split.
He slugged like 600 against them last year.
Yeah. You can move. I mean, you can move. He doesn't always have to play second base. You can give Daza a day here and there. I mean, Daza doesn't have much of a platoon split, but he's not as good against lefties as Flores is. If David Wright's healthy, he should obviously be facing every lefty he can.
Yeah.
But I think you're going to see a fair amount of Homer Flores. And I also think injuries are going to queer this by May 15th anyway.
Yeah.
Our next email is from one of our many Davids. Dear Jeff and Co., I discovered on baseballreference.com today rankings of single season K-to-walk ratios in team history. He lists the top 10. Literally. Just a proper use of literally. The Mets recorded four of the top 10 K-to-walk ratio performances in team history last season. For the record, that would be Jacob deGrom, Noah Syndergaard, Matt Harvey, and Bartolo Colon. Do you think this kind of performance is sustainable? At any rate, we should all appreciate how special the staff was last year. It is absolutely sustainable. There's 10 guys here, and six of them happened in the last three seasons. And there's a very good reason for that. Well, it's a confluence of two events. One, the Mets have a very good pitching staff right now. Two, strikeout rates have been rising throughout baseball history, but that rate of rise has accelerated recently. I think Brett Saberhagen's 1994 11-1 strikeout to walk ratio is safe.
Yeah, he probably walked half a guy an inning or something.
Right.
Or
so it's nine or something. So the weird thing about this is Bartolo has the best shot at breaking that because of his control. You have to walk less than 1/9 for the ratio to work.
Right.
I mean, he's pitched for the Mets for 2 years now and has two of the top 10 K to walk rates in team history. He didn't walk anybody. He doesn't strike out anybody. That's sort of the argument for K to walk rate versus K percentage minus walk percentage.
Yeah.
I just think give both numbers and you can probably figure it out on your own what kind of pitcher they are.
Right.
But I mean, for the record,
that's why strikeout to walk can be a little deceptive.
Okay. I mean, there's a reason guys like, you know, Rick Reed and Bartolo Colon are on it.
Yeah.
They don't walk anybody. They also don't strike out that many batters. I mean, would you rather have? I mean, Saberhagen did both. Saberhagen, one of the most underrated pitchers in baseball history. One of the few multiple time Cy Young winners not in the Hall of Fame because he was never healthy. But
yeah, if you look over like the span of say Dwight Gooden's career,
yeah, I mean, Saberhagen's right there.
He's right there. Yeah.
Our next email, last email, is from Corey, Jeff and host. When I saw an Amazing Avenue Audio drinking game podcast in my feed, I got very excited. You shouldn't have been. However, and this might be due to the fact that I've only been a regular listener since July, I was expecting a podcast with this title to be wasn't what it actually was. It wasn't me just getting smashed for an hour and 10 minutes. What it was, obviously, was Jeff asking people I don't know personally questions about players I, for the most part, had never heard of before, except for Ike Davis. Man, I miss Ike Davis. You and Ike Davis's dad. What I was hoping it was going to be was Jeff and his co-host of the day creating a 2016 Mets drinking game for us all to play, either on a game-by-game basis or over the course of a season. Things like one sip if Lagares hits a ground ball, one drink if Conforto gets a start against a lefty, one shot if Bartiolo gets a hit, and so on. So my question is, can you do that now? I think we need a list of sips, very likely to happen. Drinks, not expected, not unexpected either. And shots, this is going to hurt in the morning, but it's worth it because of what I just saw. I'd like to respectfully request you remove injuries from any list, though. I don't want to add misery to misery, no matter how certain I am of pulled intercostals and Darno freak accidents. Can't wait to hear the list. Thanks again from Rhode Island. Corey, I think this intersects well with like the GKR drinking game.
Yeah, I actually was thinking about that today. Because one of the things I was like, you got to take a sip every time Keith sighs, but there's a separate game for that.
Yeah, I mean, Bartolo is always a good one. maybe a drink every time Bartolo walks a guy, or finish your. I had a finisher glass one. I was busy at work today. I didn't have time to sketch this out as well as I would have liked. But I think it was finish your drink if Eric Campbell gets a pinch hitting appearance at a big spot.
I mean, if Bartolo gets an extra base hit, you got to do like a double shot, because he's got like one in the last 2 years.
Sure.
So that's like he's seeing a unicorn. I think you should finish. You should have to finish your drink if Cespedes. Well, here's what you should. You should have to take a gulp if Cespedes hits a second deck home run.
Yeah, I had one for upper deck home run. I think it's just me and Cespedes now that Murph's gone. So
you should probably do a shot and a beer if he hits one to the third deck.
Yeah. A sip if he has the canary yellow sleeve on. Yeah.
Let's see. Lucas Duda, homers off a lefty. I would do a shot.
Yeah, that seems good. I like that.
I'm trying to think of the rare.
Maybe
things.
A drink sip. If David Wright makes the charging bare hand throw.
That's a good one.
Mm.
I think a sip for every swing strike Familia gets on his splitter.
Okay.
Just a list of things I want to see this year. A lot of every time Cespedes throws somebody out from the outfield, take sure. a sip. And,
every time, take a drink. Every time Curtis Granderson works back from 0-2 to 3-2.
There you go. Take a drink if Cespedes commits a 2-base error. Finish your drink if it's a 3-base error. Which he did. I think he had a three.
There was an inside the park home run there, I think, in the last snap series. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one I was thinking of.
Take a drink every time a Mets pitcher strikes out Bryce Harper on a fastball above the hands. It's a good base. That's a good base.
Just, I was just thinking of rare things that could possibly happen this year. I mean, there could legitimately
how about
be...
a sip for every quick pitch by Familia or Robles?
There you go. Finish your drink if they give up a home run on it.
We did already. That happened, I feel like.
Yes. And then got really sad.
Yeah, it got very sad.
I think there could be a no-hitter this year, in which case you should probably have to shotgun a beer.
Get out the beer bong.
Yeah.
If it's Bartolo, it has to be a double something. So a double IPA, double Sky Imperial.
It could happen. Especially against that. I mean, I've been saying this for the last couple of years, but because some of those teams have been so bad, but between the Braves, Marlins, I guess the Marlins aren't that in the same class as the Phillies and Braves, but could be a no-hitter this year.
They have the pitchers to do it, certainly. Maybe a drink for every shot of Stephen Matz's grandfather in the stands.
Yeah.
That's a good base. Hopefully someone was writing that down so it wasn't us, Corey.
Yeah.
Those are your emails. Once again, you can email the podcast at podcast@amazonavenueaudio.com. We'll wrap things up with an IFK Gothenburg update. IFK Gothenburg kicked off their Svenska Cupen defense this past weekend in Gothenburg against Super Etten foes. Spreden? I don't know if it's Supretten or Superetten. As we've established on the show, I think over the last year, my Swedish, not that great.
Mm-hmm.
But they drew 1-1. Not good. Okay. They apparently missed a lot of opportunities, especially my man in the midfield, Soren Reeks. Their goal came from their new central defender from PSV Eindhoven. That's not a great result. They're going to have to slam the next two teams they play to advance, which should not be a problem because neither of them are top division teams either.
Wait, to advance? I thought the season just started.
Well, it's a cup competition, so it's a group stage essentially.
Oh, so like a beginning of the season cup?
Right, they start the cup early there, the actual season that kick off until it gets warmer.
So like their version of the
The CFA Cup
FA
is,
Cup? FA
yeah,
Cup.
I mean it's structured more like sort of a World Cup qualifying type thing, where you play everyone in your division once or your group once. But yes, essentially.
I like that because, well, I like it especially in the English League because you get teams in the EPL playing against teams in League One.
This is true.
It's fun.
I like it too. I liked it more before Sheffield Wednesday effed up against Shrewsbury Town. Otherwise, they would have had Manchester United at home in this past in round five this past weekend. They effed it up and they drew 1-1 with QPR after Nuhu had a penalty saved. I was not happy about that either. But onward and upwards, they've got Hull away on Friday, which is a TV game which I will be watching in New York. And yeah, we all know how that goes for me. So.
Yes.
About as well as our drinking game podcast.
Yeah.
That about does it, Greg.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to plug. I mean, I have my the Mets list is going up at Baseball Prospectus on Thursday. I'll be chatting in the afternoon after that, so feel free to submit questions, trolling me or otherwise. I do have final say there, so. But feel free to troll me. It's never
Yes.
stopped anyone in the past.
Please add him on Twitter.
Also, you can at me on Twitter. I don't remember what's next week. I should look this up. We have a schedule.
Have no idea.
Let's see what next week is.
You've done outfielders, you've done relievers.
It's one of the infields. It's either corner infield or middle infield. I don't remember. It is middle infield with Aaron York and his brand new microphone.
Hey.
So that's what you have to look forward to next week on another edition of Amazing Avenue Audio.
Makes a car not just beautiful, but beautifully made? Is it the engineering? The precision finish? Or is it the way it makes you feel? Until the end of February, enjoy a test drive in any new Seat, including the multi-award winning Seat Leon, and receive an additional £500 towards your purchase as part of our February feel-good drive. Visit seat.co.uk for your nearest participating dealer. Offer applies to orders taken by the 29th of February and registered by the 31st of March. T's and C's apply.